Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the TF Podcast, where we discuss technology and business and finance. Sometimes that revolves around cryptocurrency and blockchain. I'm excited for my next guest. His name is Marley Gray. He's been a long time at Microsoft and doing some really interesting things there when it comes to enterprise blockchain and just leading that charge. So with that, Marley, I'd love if you could introduce yourself to everybody.
Sure. Hi, I'm Marley Gray. I'm a principal architect on the Azure blockchain engineering team. We now call it there's two teams. We're spun the Azure blockchain engineering team off into a sort of companion team called the Azure multi-party engineering team, which is focused on sort of applied sciences, if you will. Part of that, as I'm working in multi-party engineering, is talking to business people, and have subsequently sort of inadvertently created some frameworks that we've used to create and spin off a couple of it's one initiative called the Inner Work Alliance. Which is a much bigger scope than what originally started, but that's a long story in itself. But that's my primary role at Microsoft.
Nice. Well, I definitely want to get into that. Before we even get into, I guess, what you've been doing the last couple of years, walk me through the early days. Like, how did you first get involved in technology, and what just made it interesting to you, kind of leading to where you're at?
Well, how far back do you want to go? Yeah, I mean, if you get back to like hard diskless computers, just kind of grew up with it. A lot of my peers, and none of us were computer science majors, because there were maybe one or two institutions that could actually teach us something. As we grew up, cutting our teeth with computers that you had to program just to do anything meaningful with.
Yeah.
Once I got to Microsoft, though, back 20 years ago, started out in financial services. The intersection of finance and technology was always very interesting to me. Meandering through found myself in New York City running our innovation labs for financial services, and sort of backed my way into blockchain and sort of the rest is sort of history.
Yeah, let's dig on there for a second.
Blockchain.
Yeah. So let's dig on there. So I'm assuming in the innovation for the financial services is you got to discover a lot of the pain points that financial services experience, and how to solve and optimize and so forth. And walk me through kind of how that helped influence you really kind of leading the charge with blockchain initiatives and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. So back, I started in 2014 when I moved up to New York to run the innovation labs. Blockchain and primarily it was just Bitcoin really at the time, and yeah. And it was completely wholly dismissed in financial services, and I had tinkered with it a bit and thought it was a novel sort of academic approach to financial services, and I think it was the summer of 2015, and I had my apartment to myself. I lived in Manhattan at the time, and actually ended up going into the office on a weekend because my kids were gone, and I was like a batching it at the time, and spent a weekend tinkering around with the frontier release of Ethereum, trying to stand up a private blockchain, and just because I wanted to play with it and talk to some of my peers at some of the larger financial institutions that have relationships at the time, mm-hmm. wanted to see if they were interested in it, and we just sort of garaged it, and I figured out a way to create it. Was back then, to create a private blockchain was kind of hard. Well, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
To do, and I figured out a way to get it done and do it in the cloud. So it was that sort of intersection of the cloud at the time was coming in vogue, and blockchain. And so, hey, here's an easy way for you to stand up a sandbox. you know, us professionals in financial services, we don't like to make a fool of ourselves on a public network. We like to fail miserably in private. And well, that's essentially what we allowed people to do, is that to fail miserably in private at a very low cost. And, you know, initially started out with, you know, just the Ethereum as the Go version at the time. But and we started onboarding a bunch of other blockchains. And at the time I was like, surely someone in Redmond knows what this is about. And I kept reaching out to my peers and the product groups and saying, who's your lead on blockchain? And I would just get these blank stares. What are you talking about? You know, and I would explain it. And finally, it got up to Satya and Peggy Johnson, who just left, is leaving Microsoft now to take a CEO position. She was the head of BD, and they just said, hey, let's just grab this guy in New York and plop him in Redmond and have him figure out what our strategy is in engineering. And yeah. So I spent several years in Redmond and started the blockchain engineering team. And now it's sort of spawned another team called the multi-party engineering team. And that's sort of how this whole thing evolved.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, that's an awesome story. It's kind of like not a hobby, but, you know, just a level of interest on your own to then turn that into, you know, what you get to do for work. So what were those initial conversations like with the financial institutions when you were first talking to them, when you were first tinkering them? Were they positive? Were they think you were crazy?
Oh, well, you know, when you go in and say blockchain, well, there we go. What's that? It's sort of like Bitcoin. And they go, oh, you know, yeah. Don't even talk to me about that. And I was like, no. And then we talk about contracts. And that's where it got interesting, because then you started thinking outside. You're not talking about currency. You're talking about, you know, multi-party. We didn't call it multi-party at the time, but, you know, workflows and contracts, financial derivatives, whole sorts of things. I think we actually built a swap contract was the first one. It was interesting. Sort of experiment, and we used that as a description, and we started, you know, socializing that, and from there it got hooks when they started to see, hey, we can create these contracts, and, you know, not all markets are regulated. There are probably some places where we can use this and really solve some of our seemingly untractable problems. So, you know, that it really took off from there. And had peers down the street at NASDAQ at the time were, you know, working with some of these startups, and we had lots. We were literally on the, well, one block away, but it was a crosstown block, which is a long walk, you know, certainly depending on the time of year. And we had lots of conversations about this. And so it was actually a good time in financial service. JP Morgan was getting involved and all that good stuff as well.
Nice.
So the early conversations were good. But it took a while for it to bubble up to like a key decision maker, you know, where somebody actually said, let's go do this.
Sure. And you know, and so with that, you know, kind of, I guess, fast forwarding a little bit, you know, you often have quote unquote, like blockchain altruists who might say like, oh, well, a, you know, enterprise blockchain isn't necessarily blockchain, or it is, or it isn't, or it's not Bitcoin. And so that way, that means it's not, you know, truly decentralized. Do those things matter? And, you know, because from a software perspective, you know, typically when you're building software, it's all about solving your business requirement and your technical requirement, right? So what's your response to that? Does it matter? You know, it seems as though from an enterprise standpoint, the most important thing is solving your business and your tech requirements first, right? And so whatever technology allows you to do that, you're going to do it, but you're not going to necessarily do things for the altruistic reason behind it. What's your thought there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you're going to have to, so for the decentralized sort of purists and the, you know, fully democratized public blockchains, there's a place for that. I think it's like core infrastructure. There's certain use cases that is just a really no-brainer where you want that kind of stuff. But there's a whole set of workloads that will not, the business requirements for privacy and performance, for example, and scalability, just aren't there. And they're not going to be there for some time. And even it's debatable if that's appropriate to have everything put on to, you know, a public network. So, you know, when we look at the sort of explosion of the enterprise blockchain stacks, it's an evolutionary process. Everyone was trying to solve these, you know, business requirements using different technical techniques. You know, and that evolution starting to pay some dividends, and we're starting to see some, I think we're getting ready to see the next, you know, sort of wave, a generation of distributed technologies. What I like to call on the enterprise side is distributed enough, right?
Yeah.
And be pragmatic about what it is you're trying to do. How can we meet the privacy and performance requirements and the business requirements? And also make these things approachable and understandable, not just to financial services, but to the industries financial services wants to sell into, right? We should make the distributed ledger applications and products that financial services builds consumable in other distributed ledger contexts that are not financial services, right? That's the whole thing. We got to create net new business. How can we chase net new business in financial services using this technology? So, you know, with that, we have to encourage the creation of multiple networks that might be industry context or even cross industry context. And I think we're starting to see that.
Yeah. And what might be some examples of that? Like whether that be industry verticals or, I don't know, companies, if you can talk about it, that you think show that shift or that change?
Well, the first sort of big workload out of the gate was everything has been about trade finance and logistics and sort of working in that space. I'm pretty tired of talking about that one.
So, sure, totally.
So we've been looking
bean,
at
when the coffee bean goes from the farmer
like,
and goes
track and trace. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Now okay. We know it's blocked. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Right. But those things really make sense. And the one that, you know, I've been working on the last little while is sort of the intersection of sort of the sustainability movement that we've had in corporate America, mm-hmm. And the, you know, corporations around the world, and try to, you know, get our hand around greenhouse gas emissions and what's there. And one of the interesting things that happened, you know, at Microsoft, we've been working sort of with our partners, you know, partner platforms to look at next generation ways and applying use cases to them and not just leading by technology for technology's sake. We need to make sure we're solving a problem, either, you know, creating a new opportunity or fixing something. Right. And then at Microsoft, we came up with this huge, hey, by 2030, we're going to be carbon negative. And by 2050, we're going to be historically negative, meaning we're going to like do Back to the Future, Terminator stuff. We're going to go back and kill our carbon back from 1978 or something, right? It's like, all right, how are we going to do this? And when you look at it and you look at, all right, well, one of the problems that you have is Microsoft has an emissions footprint, and the way emissions are calculated is there's this greenhouse gas protocol. I can go ad nauseum into this, but it's essentially an accounting thing where you calculate, you know, your energy consumption from your energy companies and your water company and all that stuff. And you calculate your scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. And those are essentially things that you generate in your everyday running a business. And then there's the scope 3 thing. The scope 3 thing is everything you're pulling in by all the products from your supply chain, which becomes this massive footprint. You know, when we build an Azure data center, all of the hardware and all of the air conditioning units and everything that goes into the carbon footprint is massive. Mm-hmm. But we can run that data center off of, you know, water, wind, you know, solar and all that stuff. But that doesn't get rid of, we can't out efficiency, and we can't efficiency ourselves into a carbon negative position. We have to go in and affect the market. And how do we do that? We have to, you know, encourage the offsetting of carbon. There's a whole set of technologies around, you know, agricultural, sustainable farming. There's, you know, forestation projects, things like that. And those things need to be financed. And the way they're financed is they use these things called carbon offsets. They're not carbon credits. People call them credits, but they're really not. A credit is like a permission. It's, I give you permission to emit X tons of greenhouse gases. If you happen not to emit that much and you have some left over, you can go sell those credits to somebody else that's spending more, right? That's what a credit is. An offset is, hey, I planted forests and I can prove that I removed X tons of carbon from the atmosphere. I get this offset that I can then go sell to the market where Microsoft needs to go lower their scope 3 emissions. We can't do it directly. We can buy that offset our scope 3 emissions and lower our total effective emissions.
Mm-hmm.
That market is a nightmare. It's a disaster. So when we looked at this, we said, okay, well, how would we go about approaching this? And I was like, well, there's a couple of problems we have here. You have two separate markets. You have a regulated market, you have a voluntary market. They have the same sort of measurements and underpinnings, but you know, until Paris becomes a thing, which is not gonna be anytime soon, this voluntary market we need to sort of prop up and give some infrastructure to, because the price of carbon is just all over the place. So there's, what are the first things you have to do? Is you have to agree on, okay, how do we represent carbon offset as a digital asset, as a token, right? How would we represent that? What does that mean? How can I look at that thing on a blockchain or distributed ledger and know and trace the value back to the actual source and trust that that thing is authentic and all that good stuff? And how do we do that? We can't do it as Microsoft. We have to go out and do it in an open way and bring everybody in and do that. And that's how we sort of spun up. Well, the InnerWork Alliance is not just about sustainability, but that's the mechanism we're using to drive sustainability through that organization. And so that's sort of, I don't even know how we got to this point, but that's essentially what we've been working on, is what's that applied science and what's a canonical example where we think distributed ledger blockchain can solve a really big problem.
Totally.
It's a big opportunity space.
So I guess going right into the InnerWork Alliance, so you're basically just allowing, or it's like an alliance to help with the tokenization of things, or is it like tokenizing everything? What do you want to tokenize?
Well, so it seriously started out, there's this thing called the token taxonomy framework, which I built in Microsoft initially just as an internal thing, because we had all these teams coming to us and saying, hey, I heard about tokenization, but isn't that all about cryptocurrencies? And I'm like, yes and no, it can be other things. And it's just a massive amount of confusion. I found myself repeating myself over and over and over again. So I took the holidays off and spent some time and ended up coming out with this taxonomy of the way it's essentially a composition framework for that lets you model out, not using programming languages, but any business person can model out a token for a scenario. So you could like create a bill of lading token. It's a composition framework, and the parts that the composite parts are these standard definitions and terms, like a fractionable fungible is a fungible token that can be subdivided or is divisible, right? A whole fungible is a fungible token that is, it can only be represented in whole numbers. You can't have a fraction of it. Same thing for non-fungible, and you have those things. But then we have these notions of behaviors like transferable and non-transferable. Well, those are business concepts people can understand. You know, if I have a non-transferable token, we know what that is. It's like a diploma, right? I get a diploma from my college. I can't go sell it to you and let you use that diploma, because it was given to me as non-transferable. But if I have a property title, that's a non-fungible, transferable, I could then transfer that to you. I should be able to model that out consistently, because we're surrounded by tokens, and business people, they just don't use that token speak. So the TTF initial goal was to let business people understand the concepts, have a common set of terms and definitions, and then a framework to be able to model out without getting programmers involved and create a, ultimately what you spit out is a solid set of requirements for somebody to go implement the thing. Which is ultimately, you know, very valuable. And we can standardize on that and have people build interoperable implementations based on those specifications. So the TTF started, and we spun it out into something called the Token Taxonomy Initiative. Initially, it was hosted in the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance, which I helped start too. I've now sort of I removed myself from the board from that so I could then spin the TTF off into the InnerWork Alliance. Because it's more than tokens. It's now you have a token base. And then we have this contractual framework called the InnerWork framework on top of it. And then above that, there's an analytical framework because multi-party analytics is a thing too. So it's all about multi-party frameworks. How can we define these things in a consistent way? So in the InnerWork Alliance, we have these technical working groups that all they do is define these frameworks. They're not creating standard tokens. They're just creating standardized parts that these other groups, these business working groups, like the sustainability working group, will be able to use those tools and create a carbon offset token using the framework in a standard way that is implementation neutral, right? You, mm-hmm. Anyone can take that and go, hey, I'm going to go implement this on blockchain Y, and I'm going to do it on blockchain Z. And we're going to use the same terms, same definitions. We'll have the same interface. Interoperability should be pretty easy from a layer above, right? We can do it from a wallet, for example. So that's essentially what the InnerWork Alliance is. It's really the frameworks that support, you know, these business people, the domain specialists, to go in and say, hey, we're going to have a trade finance, you know, the business working group, or one that's focused on, I've already mentioned sustainability, but you could have one about e-money or central bank money or whatever you wanted to do, and open that up to all members.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because it's like thinking through, you know, what is the representation of value in said network, and then essentially tokenizing that representation of value. You know, I think one of like the easiest examples for people to think about is just like loyalty points overall, right? Mm-hmm. Because like, you know, you go to Safeway and you buy something and you get, you know, club points, or you purchase something online and you get points, right? And so like, you know, tokenizing that is it's kind of like a wrapper, right? Like you're putting like a digital wrapper around that token. So I imagine in like the carbon credit aspects, or the carbon, not credits, what would we say?
Offsets. Yeah. Well, you can do credits too. I mean, carbon credits are tokenized as well.
So. Yeah, it's kind of like a wrapper around that. Do you kind of agree with that, or what are your thoughts when you think about how that goes?
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, it's a digital representation of something. So the carbon offsets and the carbon credit, they are what we call reference tokens. They point to something else. So the carbon offset token actually represents a measure of carbon in metric tons that was removed from the atmosphere. You can't like go handle that thing, right? Unless we have somebody that's, you know, capturing carbon out of the air and spitting out carbon bricks. Then yeah, we can, you know, you have your carbon ton and it points to these carbon bricks, just like you would tokenize a bar of gold, right? And then you have these intrinsic ones that are like a cryptocurrency, a Bitcoin, where there is no coin, said physical coin, that's like made of gold or platinum or some exotic material that actually has worth. The actual digital representation is intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. So those notions or those concepts are ones that people kind of understand, but they don't know how to articulate.
Sure.
Right. And so when you talk about a wrapper, it is like that. It's how do I articulate that I'm tokenizing this physical thing, or this, it still might have a paper representation. So the one that we always talk about is, an invoice token. What is an invoice token? Well, it's really a document. You still have a piece of paper that somebody printed off the invoice, you scan it in, create a PDF, store it somewhere, get its hash, you know, tokenize the thing. And then it has some invoice properties like hanging off. So you can query the ledger and look at that token and say, oh, here's the invoice number. This is the date. This is the total invoice amount. Maybe that's what would be public. The rest of it, you'd have to go crawl and find the actual invoice itself. So that token is a wrapper around that physical paper, but lets us digitally represent and then use that and to transfer around a supply chain, for example.
Totally. So with the InnerWork Alliance, is the goal to be more like a working group, or to establish like a level of policy, or is it more even just like a framework for other people to operate in? How would you think?
Yeah. So, yeah. So if we think about the technical frameworks, the token taxonomy framework, the Interwork framework, and then the analytic multi-party analytic framework. Those frameworks are the only thing they're doing is they're creating structure and sort of schema for how you define stuff that comes out of a business working group. So when I go and define the carbon offset token, I can say it's a fungible token that's subdividable by 8 decimal places that, is transferable. It has all these behaviors. It might have a couple of properties hanging off of it, like who the registry was that certified it, what project it belongs to, those types of things. And that's a standard definition. That definition is created using the TTF. The business working group, they don't worry about the TTF stuff. They just write down, this is what this thing does, right? And then we have a liaison that goes and plugs it into the TTF tool. Now there's a GUI tool you can drag and drop and design a token using a WYSIWYG designer, like the old Visual Basic days where you built a form, you laid those things out. We have that as well. And Envision over time, we'll have the same thing for the contractual bit. So you'll be able to have tokens visually built and then contracts on top. And so those frameworks are just in support of these business working groups. This is where the vast majority of the work will be done.
Got it.
And when we say business working group, that's where we're not attracting, we don't want the technologists in the room. I mean, they can be in the room, but we don't want them leading it. We want the subject matter experts, the scientists that are doing carbon offsetting measurement and know what the vital details. What is the minimum viable blockchain data that needs to be on the blockchain for this offset to have meaning to someone else on the same network? What is that? Then help us weed it. And we have people say, that property really isn't valuable to be on the ledger. We can link to it and go find it. So we want to, again, get that minimum set of shared data and then come to a standard agreement for how that is digitally represented. And then we'll document that in the TTF and we'll document contracts in the Interwork Alliance so that somebody goes and implements it in Solidity or DAML or whatever implementation language they wanted to use. They would have that set of requirements they build according to that specification. They could get certified on it.
Sure. And then so, because you're using either like those different smart contract frameworks that you mentioned, I'm assuming is there also, it's not necessarily married to like a particular blockchain and how this is
possible? Yeah, it's
not. Yeah.
It's not even blockchain specific. It's more, we say they're distributed ledger concepts.
Sure.
So we're at the root, but you can implement distributed ledger concepts in a central database.
Right.
Yeah,
so exactly. So going back to what we talked about originally, right, is that you are solving for your requirements and then just implementing some of the technology out of blockchain perhaps or learnings to then solve what you need for in your business or tech requirements.
Yeah. And when you define those things in a standard way and you articulate things like a unique fungible token, sort of leans itself to what we call UTXO blockchain, right? It's an unspent transaction output blockchain, not a balance-based blockchain where you just have a smart contract address and that's your balances are kept there instead of each individual receipt or unspent transaction output. That's something a business person is not going to be able to rationalize. But if they can go in and say, hey, I need this fungible token to be unique. It needs to have unique properties that another fungible token in the same class would have a different property value. That's sort of going to let you make a rational implementation decision for that specification rather than just saying, hey, we've picked a blockchain. I know a lot of enterprises, they went out and did these hackathons and they picked a blockchain implementation before they knew what they were going to do with it.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That became a problem, right? Then seeing the business sort of, we'll just change the way the business operates to meet with the implementation. That's like, nah, that's not going to work.
Yeah, no, I've definitely experienced that. We work with some different clients and kind of the same thing. They're like, well, we really want to use this blockchain. I was like, well, we don't even know what the product market fit is just yet for what we're trying to build. So we might not even need blockchain, right? So like there's no point in having this conversation on what blockchain yet. Let's keep it in mind, but it's not going to be a business or a tech driver, at this early stage, right?
Yeah, we think Interwork's a good forum. It's a forum for So it's an interesting bit is, you know, we work with everybody and we're always, and we're trying to work in consortiums and so few consortiums are successful because there's no forum for them to go through and hash out these things. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the Interwork Alliance serves as a great place for you if you're going to form a consortium, but you're not exactly sure how the business model is going to work, who's going to own what, you know, what does the format look like? Interwork Alliance is a great place to steer these organizations and say, let's spin up a business working group just for this consortium that's going to focus on this use case, because whatever you generate, the artifacts you generate, you contribute back. And then the next group that comes along can reuse the stuff that you built. And benefit from that. So it's going to sort of like raise the tide for everyone to try to solve these problems from a business perspective.
Definitely. Yeah, I want to move forward to just kind of just what's going on overall in tech and so forth, and particularly around things like stable currencies within banking. So like the central bank currencies and so forth. And, you know, my guess is that Microsoft would find its way into that line of business at some point, if not already. But, you know, kind of how do you think about how banks have been thinking through stable currency and having either their own stable token or some sort of representation of that?
Yeah, again, it's it comes back to sort of modeling, you know, what is a stable coin, stable currency? What is it? How is it represented? Then how is it going to be used, right? Because then sort of the first sort of, I worked with some folks on the e-money sort of specification, which is more central bank money, not necessarily stable coin, but there's lots of stable coins out there that are pegged to like the dollar or the euro. Yeah. And then you figure out, okay, well, how are you going to do this? Is it for intrabank settlement or interbank settlement in the Eurozone, which is very common? So we've seen some implementations for what it's going to be used for. I haven't really seen much momentum, you know, trying to push this on consumers yet. Mm-hmm. I've seen some dabblings and things like that, but I think it's a natural evolution to get there. We've seen with some of the stuff Apple's done with their card and their cash stuff, you know, from, again, that gets back into sort of the payment instrument, the wallet stuff, you know, and it gets back into, depends on how it's going to be used. If it's a consumer facing, it's completely different than if it's just bank facing.
Right now it seems like it's been definitely more for just allowing for a bank to operate more efficiently within their own network, right? Like you're saying, not necessarily consumer facing though.
Yeah. Yeah. And you could see it being used in different lines of business, asset management, you know, commercial banking, eventually maybe, you know, who knows. Yeah. You know, commercial paper is kind of all over the place. But yeah, I mean, there's, and payments and settlement over there, primarily where we're seeing that kind of stuff.
Totally. Curious what your thoughts might be on DeFi. It's DeFi has just become, you know, pretty hot topic lately. And, you know, it seems like the main reason why people are interested in DeFi is the financial instrument of it, right? The interest and so forth, and sure, there are other technological aspects of it, but really it's, hey, I get interest and, you know, I earn some money, for my crypto, you know, kind of. I'm curious what your thoughts are on there. If you thought much about that. And then does that start getting enterprise adoption, do you think, anytime soon?
Yeah. I don't know. It is an interesting space. You know, it's always, it's sort of the asset management space. I have funds I need to park somewhere. Where's the best place for me to get my return? And it's a natural place for DeFi sort of to mirror some of the commercial and investment banking sort of strategies at a lower scale. I mean, it's a much more approachable business, but they're going to have the same sort of, you know, challenges and issues. I think the enterprises, you know, you look at the enterprise themselves as consumers of DeFi, I don't think you'll see that. I think you might see it. It would be, the interesting bit would be in small business frameworks around DeFi. I don't know. It's a real interesting space. And we haven't dabbled much into it, you know, other than, you know, we do talk to some fintechs that are sort of looking at that, and
yeah,
we're not highly opinionated on any one particular approach.
Right. Well, how about, you know, you are a leader in the space, but you are also a consumer, right? So what gets you interested as a consumer just in the space in general? Blockchain, Bitcoin, crypto, everything in between, even just finance. What kind of gets you excited about what's happening right now, or what are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, you know, I've been wholly consumed by the sustainability stuff for a while. I think, you know, there's opportunity to, you know, move sustainability and carbon, greenhouse gas into a real commodities market. And from there, you could get, right now there's just spot markets that you have. But if you could get to the point where you could do some derivatives and futures, where I could say, hey, and if I could tell you what the price of oil, like, you know, a futures contract on oil would be, and any commodity, right? I can't do that for carbon, right? I should be able to do that for carbon. And because it's going to take, you know, everyone on the planet, there's interesting spinoffs and things like that. Could we create a digital asset that has consumer facing value around carbon? Because, you know, there's lots of people that say, hey, you know, how can I lower my own carbon footprint? How do I measure my, you know, success? How do I do those types of things? And right now we're just trying to do the basics of monetizing, you know, at a large scale for large scale offset projects and in the regulated markets, and how do corporates report, you know, sustainability goals through, you know, these ESG metrics that investors are looking at. But eventually, that's the thing that kind of excites me. Are there new types of, I mean, people have written papers about, could carbon be the base of a new cryptocurrency? And I've seen a couple of papers. I think there was actually an implementation. To get to something like that, you have got to have like worldwide global financial infrastructure to be, and have carbon be a true commodity before you could do that.
Got it.
So I think the stuff that we're working on here in the InterWork Alliance and sort of pushing those forward, it's going to get people thinking about those types of things. How do we get, that's the thing that most excites me. And if I think more broadly than that, I lose focus, and there's just so much going on. It's so broad. Right. It's like, wow, that's super interesting. I'll go over there and squirrel over there. And then, you know, there's too many things to get down that path.
Yeah. The fun of being a technologist. Well, Marley, so question I like to ask everybody, as my closing question is, what is a question that you have that you'd like to ask our listeners that they can think about as they go about their day?
So one would be, would you accept payment to remove your privacy constraints? That was one question that someone asked me, and I didn't have a really good answer, is if I could monetize my personal information, how would I like to take that payment? And my answer to them was, if you could put cash money into my bank account and let you track me, you know, and my behaviors, that would be a killer use case. And then I would think, you know, would that be something that your listeners would do? Would they also accept payment? You know?
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, because you hear that question, or like people saying that they're solving for that whenever, like, oh, well, we're going to monetize data, we're going to monetize value. And like, I don't know that anybody's truly done that just yet, but you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
I have a theory that with the Cambridge Analytica stuff with Facebook that happened a few years ago, is like part of the bothersome that people experienced was they didn't get to participate in that data extraction, like monetarily, right? Like, it's not like people left Facebook. Yeah, sure, some people did. But so I think that's kind of interesting. Yeah, I like that question. Nice. Well, Marley, what are some good ways that people can either stay in touch with you or pay attention to what you're doing and follow what you're up to and so forth?
Yeah. So, you know, just for the InterWork, you can go to interwork.org. Enter Work, not make sure I pronounce it correctly. And we just started that. We launched it June 2nd.
Oh, wow.
So we're just getting started with our technical working groups have started up. We're getting ready to start up our first business working group. And we want to, have as much participation. The excitement around that has been very, very high. And then from a Microsoft perspective, I've been quiet for some time working on this multi-party engineering stuff. So when I have something to say, it'll either show up on the Microsoft blog through some press release or something like that. But nothing on the radar in the next couple of weeks. But it's just blogs at Microsoft, and you can just look at Marley G and you'll pull up the historical stuff, but nothing of late.
Excellent. Well, hey, Marley, I really appreciate your time. It's good to chat with you here. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Everybody, thank you for listening and watching another episode of the TF Podcast. Please make sure that you're liked and subscribed. Filling in those stars goes a long way to making sure that more people see our great podcasts. Also, please make sure that you're following us at TF Labs _ on Twitter, as well as at JG Product. And you can learn more at tflabs.io. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.